taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is Caitlin Bailey. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am fine. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing very, very well. As Caitlin mentioned, I am the third most important member of a two-person team, Mark Bigney, and we're going to be talking about some video games. We're going to be talking about our feelings about those video games, and for those Americans amongst us, no other salient feelings as we record this on November the 10th. Anyway, so we're going to talk about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about our retro game of the week, which is The Lost Vikings in our goof segment. We're going to talk about our feature game, which is Dragon Age The Veilguard. And then finally, we're going to be shouting out upcoming titles. So with that all in mind, Caitlin, what have you been playing lately?
All right, so mostly I've been playing Dragon Age The Veilguard. And I'm not going to talk about it here because we're talking about it later. But after I beat Veilguard, I did pick back up A Tower Full of Cats that I talked about last week, and I finished that. And then I started and finished An Arcade Full of Cats, which was also wonderful. So honestly, like, I don't have a whole bunch more to add from what I said about these games last week, but they were really fun. They're cute. I can turn off my brain and not worry about anything, and it's amazing.
Presumably, what you have to add is a large number of cats.
Yes.
So is there any noticeable technical improvement? Because I got to say, this is not a dig on the genre. Like I said last week, I don't in any way mean to minimize what is a substantial source of enjoyment for a large number of video gamers. And insofar as they play video games, they are video gamers. I'm not involved in any gatekeeping of that sort. I would never dream. There was a very consistent aesthetic between this host of products from this company that releases the X Full of Cats series. And I'm just wondering if, having tried a number of them both early on in their development cycle and later on in their release cycle, if you've noticed any consistent improvement or if it really is just a sense of, this is what we do. We do the same thing over and over.
I would say it's mostly the latter. They do make some improvements through the games. Like the very first one, you can't zoom in. After that, you can start zooming in. The art definitely just has improved over time, as happens when somebody practices doing a whole lot of art. And they experiment with different mechanics, especially, so not for the main game. The main game continues to just be like, you find a cat. Oh, sorry. You find a cat, you click the cat, you found the cat. But there's sometimes like hidden levels or bonus levels where they try something a little new, and that's always cool. But generally, it's still just, you know, you find the hidden animal or object occasionally, and you are good to go. But they do it very well.
Could you elaborate a little bit on those hidden levels where they try something new? What something new are you referring to?
Yeah, so one of them kind of turns it into a timed thing. Because it's a little bit of like a boss battle. You have to find things within a certain amount of time. It kind of like zooms in on the screen and then zooms out, and a few objects have appeared that you have to find and click in the scene before your timer runs out. Other ones is just giving you different things to find.
Wait, not cats?
Yes. Like in one of them, there was a cat gardener, and she was very sad because a bunch of like invasive caterpillars got into her garden, and you have to find all the caterpillars, and it like puts them in this little bubble, like you've shot them with like a sci-fi gun that like puts a bubble around them or something. I don't know. And that, again, mechanics wise, that's exactly the same as the cats. It just looks a little bit different on the screen.
I don't know. If I were playing X Full of Cats and I was eventually told to find some caterpillars. No, I'm serious. I might.
Yeah.
I might be suspicious that I've been subjected to a bait and switch.
It's a pretty small part of the game, and you're still helping a cat, so I gave it a pass. Yeah.
All right, that's very broad-minded of you. I'm fascinated that there are boss battles. Who are these bosses?
I don't know if you can spoil an object game, but I don't want to say because I guess it would technically be a spoiler.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I can respect that. Have you done all of the X full of cats, or are there always yet more?
I haven't yet. There's still a park full of cats, which I think is an amusement park one, which I haven't done yet, but I did install it, so you can be sure that it will be coming up soon.
So you've not yet exhausted the enthusiasm of X full of cats. You want to find more cats.
I absolutely do, and I'm sure I'm going to feel sad, alone, and empty when they're all done.
Well, that took a grim turn. Okay, well, that was an overview of Arcade Full of Cats and the inevitability of death. Thank you, Caitlin, as a representative of Entropy and the End of All Things.
Anytime. What have you been playing lately, Mark?
Well, I'd like to put this existentialism to bed, and I played Persona 5 Tactica. Now, it recently was announced that it's going to be exiting Game Pass, and so this made me think that this was a time to try it if I ever was going to. Now, one might be inclined to ask why I hadn't tried it before, because as I mentioned before, Persona 5 is one of my favorite games of all time. But the problem is, there have always been spin-offs to the Persona games, and I learned early in the days of the Persona 3 spin-offs that I did not enjoy the spin-offs. Okay. And there's a number of reasons for this. One of the reasons is because they tend to be genres that I don't very much enjoy as much sometimes. So, for example, there have been a series of rhythm games based on the Persona universe, and I don't enjoy rhythm games, so there's that. I tried them, didn't enjoy them. But then sometimes there are genres that are sort of hit or miss for me, like, for example, Persona 5 Tactica, which is a grid-based tactical-type game. But a lot of them I don't enjoy, and some of them I very much enjoy. But then there were things that I very much do enjoy, like beat-em-ups, and that was Persona 5 Strikers. I tried Persona 5 Strikers. That didn't do it for me either. And so basically, I've had a string of various crossover side story Persona games that I have not enjoyed. There's also the tone. I also find the tone of the Persona spin-off games very off-putting, for the reason that, for one thing, they tend to use a radically different art style from the core game, and so these people that I've spent a fair amount of time with look very different. In the case of Persona 5 Tactica, it's because they're all super deformed, and I have zero enthusiasm for super deformed art styles. I never have. It's one of the many reasons why I just had no real enjoyment for Final Fantasy VII, for what it's worth. It's like, oh, okay, well, I like, can't they just be rendered the way they're done in battle scenes all the time? I realize there are technical limitations, but that was one of the reasons why. And sometimes it's other aspects, but also just tonally, these are people who I saved the world with or saved someone with, and I have deep, meaningful connections, and they expect me to then dial back from whatever feelings I might have about the core cast to just chilling out with the bros, right? And that it's just, I can't get there. There's a cognitive dissonance. I would contrast this, actually, with the sort of after-stories that BioWare games tend to do, like Citadel or Trespasser, that recognize that the people who are playing this have very strong, solid feelings about this. I recognize full well that if you're designing a game like Persona 5 Tactica or Persona 5 Strikers, you don't necessarily want to assume that the people playing these games are 60 to 80 hours deep in Persona 5. I respect that. But some of us are. And speaking personally as someone who was, I find the tone dissatisfying and strangely off-putting. And so all of those things I expected coming into Persona 5 Tactica, and sure enough, that is exactly what I got out of Persona 5 Tactica. So in terms of the gameplay, there's actually a fair amount to like. They do a pretty interesting thing with positioning, which some tactical games don't do, and some do to the extent of becoming puzzly. Like Into the Breach, puzzly. Tactical Breach Wizards, at times, a little too puzzly for my tastes, but most of the time it was okay. And there's a balance to be struck, at least for my personal tastes, of making it feel like a tactical thing and rather than just some sort of abstract positional thing where everything needs to be in the right square. And I like to be able to worry about things like ability management or time management or triggering special abilities in the proper way. And one of the things that Persona 5 Tactica does, which is kind of cool, is if you have your three people form a triangle and you're able to get a vulnerable person in the middle of the triangle, you can trigger an all-out attack, which is very evocative of the all-out attacks from the Persona series. And mechanically, I found that very, very satisfying. And so that was neat. And so it was kind of like a can opener situation. You have this formation of enemies in cover, and you have to start thinking, well, okay, I have to activate this character to bring them out of cover, and then another character to make them vulnerable, and then I have to make sure that the third character can get to the position of making a triangle, and then I'm able to unleash hell into everything in the middle of it. And that part was pretty cool, and I enjoyed that. I didn't, however, like the character differentiation, because one of the ways that the Persona games gets through this is the main character is a cipher and can adopt whatever persona he wants. And that's primarily where you get the ability variation. Your squad mates are mostly there for the one thing they do. I do fire attacks. I do ice attacks, or mm-hmm. what have you. In Persona 5 Tactica, you don't have that. The main character does their element. The side characters do their element. And so frequently it's more about the core attacks and core positioning, which is fine. But it doesn't have as much personality as a game, for example, like Tactical Breach Wizards, where every character felt unique and bespoke and interesting. Whereas here in Persona 5 Tactica, these people that I normally really, really enjoy and have a lot of history with, they end up feeling more bland than I would like. And so I thought it was okay, but I'm not going to be weeping any bitter, unexpiated tears about the fact that Tactica is going to be exiting Game Pass, or indeed might already be gone. I stopped paying attention after I decided that I was okay with having just played a few hours of Tactica and was willing to move on. Now contrast this is sort of a twofer, this is the hidden turn, this is the twist. I'm the M. Night Shyamalan of video game podcasts. What has just come on Xbox Game Pass is Metal Slug Tactics, the full version. I talked about this a few weeks ago when I played the demo, and now the final version is available on Xbox Game Pass. First of all, the gamepad support is much better now. Yay. Hardly shocking in the context of demos, but there you have it. And here, the character differentiation is considerably more robust, which is weird because in the video games, they're all interchangeable up until Metal Slug 6. And even then, when they have a little bit of differentiation between them, they're still mostly the same. It's like, oh, well, this character gets a little bit more HMG ammo when they picked up HMGs, whatever. They're all just running and gunning. But in Metal Slug Tactics, they all have their own unique bespoke set of abilities. And I got a little bit, again, of that vibe of Tactical Breach Wizards, or even of something like Fire Emblem, where the class and abilities are so unique that you really have to leverage those and think carefully about your squad and what to trigger what and when, rather than just everybody needs to be in the right place to trigger the right thing. Now, to mm-hmm. be fair, Metal Slug has a little bit too much of that for my taste, because most of the time people just fire in straight lines. They all work like rooks. See, that's a tie-in to what we're going to be talking about later. That's foreshadowing. This is, again, M. Night Shyamalan of podcasting here.
Very smooth.
And I find that strangely limiting and thematically unsatisfying. It's like, dude's got a pistol. He can know how to, like, he can't just, he doesn't work in 90-degree increments. He could fire at different, but that's just a personal pet peeve of mine, whatever. And so I've been enjoying Metal Slug Tactics. It is much more pleasant, much more full of character. And it's even more evocative of the source material, because something that I'm appreciating more now, coming back to it and replaying the early levels and getting a little bit further than what was available in the demo, is this is a tactical riff on a run-and-gun video game. And you're encouraged to run. Every turn, you get a blade of armor based on how far you've moved over the course of your turn. And not entirely unlike Tactical Breach Wizards, not to the same extent, there are these little set pieces. There are these rooms that literally fall off the edge of the map once you're done with them. And you're going from stage to stage to stage. It doesn't have quite the same aggressive, satisfying pacing that Tactical Breach Wizards did, but it's definitely closer than something like Fire Emblem or Persona 5 Tactica, where it's like, okay, well, we dealt with that squad of enemies. Let's spend the next three turns getting everyone moving into position. Mm-hmm. And so Metal Slug Tactics has been very satisfying. I still find it strange how they redid all the audio. All the graphical and audio assets are entirely different from this long-running 2D series. It would have been an easy and indeed cheaper way to make it evocative of the source material, to even just carry over some of the sound clips. But I'm willing to accept that. So that is Persona 5 Tactica. That was done by P Studio and was released last year in 2023. And I've just been enjoying Metal Slug Tactics by Lakehir Studio, released very recently in 2024.
As everybody knows, presumably, if they've listened to this podcast, I am not much of a Persona player, not because I don't want to, just I haven't gotten around to it. I didn't realize that there were so many spinoffs.
Tons.
Do they do that for all of the games?
That has been true of Personas 3, 4, and 5. Persona 1 and 2,
Okay. They're
kind of the oddballs out. They didn't have the same gameplay structures, and they're less well-known. Mm-hmm. Even less well-known than the core, quote-unquote, core Shin Megami Tensei series is now. But there have been fighting games, there have been dancing games, there have been tactical games, there have been dungeon crawling games, which were slightly different from the tactical games. And there was a weird sort of beat-em-up, and it's just a thing they do. They spin off the various characters, and most of them are side stories or take place after the main story is done or what have you, and they just reuse the characters and put them in different situations. Happens all the time.
Okay, interesting. So they're just trying out new things, kind of riding on the coattails of the main game to get people interested?
That's more of a marketing question, I couldn't say.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
They're not lazy cash grabs, I can tell you that much. Like,
okay,
the fighting game is played competitively.
Nice.
The rhythm game is genuinely appreciated for people who like rhythm games and who don't like the Persona games. And many of these things are very, very well reviewed. It's a bizarre situation. Like, you know, I'm always confused when someone says they really like a movie or a band or a TV show, and they say it's their favorite thing ever, and then they devote zero effort to trying to find out other things that the same people did.
Yeah.
I understand it. Not everyone has the same approach to cultural output that I do. But after initial disappointments with the Persona spinoffs, I just kind of stopped paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when Persona 5 Tactica was released, it's like, I don't know. And that kind of persisted until I recently saw it. It's like, oh, this is your last 2 weeks to try it on Game Pass. And I'm like, okay, I guess it's worth an install in a few hours of my life. And sure enough, it's okay.
Yeah.
If anything, I think the fact that it's the cast of Persona rendered in chibi format makes it less appealing to me than mm-hmm. it had been if it had been another group of characters. So make of that what you will.
Yeah, that's fair. The Metal Slug game sounds interesting, too. I like that they kind of tried to pull stuff from the main game, like the, you know, because it's run and gun. So, you know, if you go really far, you get stuff like that seems cool. I like that.
I've been an SNK fan for a very long time, and there were some dark years, Caitlin. There were some years we were just out in the wilderness, and there was just nothing for us, nothing new, and it's a great time to be an SNK fan. What can I say?
Amazing.
Except for the whole Saudi crown prince of it all.
Well, yeah.
Try not to think too much about that.
It's fair. Okay, so that's what we've been playing lately. Moving on, we can talk about The Lost Vikings, our goof retro game. So Lost Vikings was released in 1993. It was developed by Silicon and Synapse, which is now part of Blizzard Entertainment, published by Interplay, and it's on a zillion platforms. Back in the day, it was on Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis. Nowadays, it's all over the place, including PlayStation 4. You can buy it on PCs, part of the Blizzard Arcade Collection. I think it's on Switch. It's everywhere.
Still doesn't make any sense that it's called the Arcade Collection. I do not get it.
Yeah, it's arcade, I guess, is synonymous with old-timey. I don't know.
Is it, though?
I'm not sure that it actually is, but that's the spirit in which I feel it's being used.
I have to imagine. This was actually the game selected by our voting patrons for what we should cover next in Goof. We offered them a slate of options, and the Lost Vikings took it. Thank you very, very much to our patrons. By the way, you can find us on patreon.com/amfad if you're interested in getting ad-free versions and the ability to tell us to dance according to your petty whims, as we believe in tyranny. We believe in independent media and tyranny here at All My Best Friends Are Digital. And so now we're talking about The Lost Vikings. Did you have any experience with The Lost Vikings prior to this exposure, Caitlin?
No, actually. The first time that I even knew about The Lost Vikings was during a part of a dungeon in World of Warcraft. The Lost Vikings made a cameo. And they weren't super explicit about it, but there were three dwarves with these names. That was cute. But yeah, this is the first time I ever played it. How about you?
This was something that I played back in the day, before Blizzard was a thing, and I have reasonably fond memories of it. As I've made pretty explicitly clear, I'm not huge into puzzles. And the overall vibe I would give of The Lost Vikings, it's kind of a character-based Lemmings, if you've ever played any of the Lemmings games. Effectively, in Lemmings, what you do is you have these mindless little Lemmings that you have to march towards an exit without getting them all killed. In the context of the Lost Vikings, you have three different characters, each with their own abilities, and you take direct control over each of them in turn in an attempt to get to the exit. So it's kind of platformy, kind of puzzly, mostly puzzly, in a vague sense of inverting the Lemmings formula. And despite the fact that I don't really like puzzles, the level of puzzle solving that is on display in The Lost Vikings is mostly to my taste. Again, as I was talking about in terms of tactical games, I like being able to leverage the strengths and weaknesses of specific members of some sort of squad or team in order to get to some common objective. And whether that objective is getting to the exit at the end of a platforming level or defeating all your enemies within a time limit or what have you, I'm probably equally happy with both. I'm not obsessed with violence, despite what my parole officer says.
So yeah, the three characters are Eric the Swift, and as you may guess, he is fast, he can run fast, he can jump. The other Vikings cannot really jump.
They can fall.
Yes, they sure can. and then we've got Balog the Fierce. He is the fighter of the group. He has a bow and arrow and a sword, and he can use those to damage enemies. And then we have Olaf the Stout. He holds a shield, and he can use that shield to either block projectiles from enemies or just block enemies in general. He can hold it over his head to let Eric jump on top of him to be able to get higher. And he also can weirdly use it as a parachute.
It blocks the airflow.
There's drag, I guess.
There's drag, precisely. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, apparently enough to prevent Olaf the Stout from falling like a boulder to the ground.
Are you body shaming Olaf the Stout?
No, oh my god, I love him. I laughed so much when I went down a ladder with him for the first time and I realized I could see his tiny little pixelated butt crack.
Yep. Yeah, there's a very strong cartoony vibe, and I actually really like the, this is going to sound morbid, but I really like the death animations, because what happens is when a character loses their last health point, they turn into a skeleton, but the skeleton still has their very characteristic facial hair before it crumbles into dust. There's a lot of really good animation, a lot of good character work. I also really like how Balog the Fierce walks. He just has this very strange sort of, he's like swaggering. They manage to find a way to communicate that he's like swaggering from side to side, even though it's a 2D side-scrolling game.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff here.
Yeah, lots and lots of personality. Also, something I wanted to point out is the way that this game handles its tutorial is incredibly, it is incredibly up my alley. So this game handles them in a way that I like, because I can engage with it when I want to. And I did. Like, I walked by, there's these question blocks in the first couple of stages. And you just have to hit a button. It'll tell you one paragraph, and then it's done, and you can move on, and you can keep playing the game. It's great. It's my style.
You know, I didn't initially suggest putting this on the list for our patrons to vote on because I thought that the tutorial might finally get past your iron wall of tutorial hatred. And yet here we are. I can't say that I'm disappointed.
Yep. So yeah, I engaged with every single one of those question mark blocks, and it was great.
I'm a little confused, though, because if it's purely optional, you skip it. But in this context, it was optional and you didn't skip it.
It was optional, but so I guess I was already playing the game, which is an important part of it for me. Like,
okay,
it's not something separate from the game. It is the game. And I guess part of it is I didn't feel like it would take a long time because it's just a question block. It has like one paragraph and it's done. And I think part of it is impatience with like, I don't want to spend 20 minutes doing the tutorial. I just want to go play the game. And this way it's like, okay, I can take 5 seconds to read this paragraph, less than 5 seconds, and then move on and do more playing of the game before I come across another thing that it's trying to teach me.
So if a game theoretically took its instruction manual, parceled it up into short paragraphs, and littered it about the opening level, you'd be fine with it?
Potentially, yes. Yeah, as long as they keep it short and sweet, and they just let me move on and keep playing the game. Because it's funny, because I also, like, I've gotten frustrated with role-playing games doing much the same thing, and they're trying to give me the tutorial while I play. But it's also like, oh my god, I've played 87 RPGs before. I know how, like, I know how this works. Let me continue. But Lost Vikings had the benefit of like, okay, I know that these three characters do different things. I need to learn a little bit about how to do stuff. So I don't know. I guess it just really hit the sweet spot for me.
Fascinating. Okay, so and what did you think of the actual game?
Okay, so I had fun with it. I thought that the platforming felt really good. I also don't really enjoy puzzles, but, you know, the puzzles were fine. I couldn't complain about them too much. I got a little frustrated with the fact that you lose one dwarf and you cannot complete the level anymore. And in many cases, I couldn't even make progress with the level because I needed the dwarf that I was actively playing who died.
They're not dwarves in this version. They're Vikings.
Oh, sorry. Vikings. Sorry. You're right.
You got a little, they're wow on the brain.
Stout. They're short and stout and they have beards. I don't know. But that yes, they're Vikings. You're right. So the Vikings, you know, as soon as one of them would die, the whole level is over, especially, I don't remember which level it was. It was a few of them in. I was playing Eric and he had to complete most of the level by himself. And I would get so frustrated because I would fall into water and instantly die or accidentally step on fire and burn to a crisp. It slightly took the sting off in one level when I had died multiple times and the dwarves started joking about how they should buy real estate on that level because they'd been there for so long.
Again, like, Vikings, but yes.
Oh, damn it. Vikings. You're right. Sorry.
Oh. Maybe if you knew what they were, they wouldn't die so much.
You're right. So anyway, I enjoyed it. I thought that it had a cute sense of humor. I didn't get super far, but I got a number of levels in, and I'd play it again.
Yeah, The Lost Vikings is one of those rare games where I wish it were a little more puzzly, because you don't really get many novel applications of your Vikings abilities as the game goes on. It really kind of settles into, I'm almost tempted to call it a routine, you know, Olaf scouts ahead, finds an enemy, stops there, bring up sword guy, kill sword guy, see that platforming is needed, bring up Eric over and over and over again. And it's enjoyable. It's well done. It's smooth. And again, the appealing animation and visuals really help take a lot of it off. But the pacing is sufficiently methodical, and the scenarios tend to be sufficiently stock that I eventually find it a little bit tiresome. And it's the kind of thing that I'm very happy to pick up and play a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
I kind of wish they'd pushed the envelope a little bit more earlier in terms of making the Vikings do different things. But then again, the repertoire is somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. They don't have to have like a half a dozen abilities each. That might start getting a little bit more outre. But honestly, as it is, just especially the scouting ahead with Olaf, bring up sword guy afterwards, just over and over and over again. There was this one level in particular in the third world where all the keys had been activated, all the systems had been modified, I'd busted down all the walls, and there were three enemies at a couple screens remove between me and the exit. It was just a long side-scrolling segment where there were three enemies. And so I did the same, literally did the same pattern three times in succession. It's like, this is unnecessary.
Yeah.
You are now padding the length. And now, granted, it's less obnoxious than the way they padded the length in The Lion King. But then again, saying that an SNES game is less obnoxious than The Lion King, especially on the show, is damning with faint praise. And so I wish that they had done that the level design had been a little bit more creative in terms of making you, you know, have to experiment, try new things. Because after you've played the first couple levels, you've seen most of what you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
The rest of the game in The Lost Vikings. It's just sort of wash, rinse, repeat in different constellations. And that's not ideal, I don't think.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe this game would have been more engaging if I had played it with other people. I guess, especially with the arcade collection, if you're playing the definitive edition, or if you play the Sega Genesis version, I think, you can play with up to two other people. Granted, some of these levels, particularly one I'm thinking of, where Eric the Swift does almost the entire thing and the other two just whole, you know, chill for a while, might be kind of boring to play with other people, but it would definitely help improve the pace to some degree because it was a bit tiresome being like, okay, I got him here, I have to toggle and move him and then toggle and move him. And
I agree. It's kind of a pick your poison scenario. If you're playing it single player, the pacing is unfortunate. If you're playing it multiplayer, it's unfortunate in a different way.
Yeah.
But I got to say, for a early 90s puzzle platformy thing, it's novel, it's cute, it's definitely good for a few levels at a time, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage anyone to give it a shot. Like I said, the early Blizzard work, the sort of all the pre-WoW stuff, especially the pre-Diablo stuff, there's a lot of really interesting things that they were doing. And I really think that The Lost Vikings, it was extremely popular when it was released. Mm-hmm. It's held up pretty well, I think. But again, the level design kind of lets it down.
Yeah, I think something else that might have been able to help is if there was a way to, like, I don't know, a toggle to get your brothers to follow you. Or not your brothers, sorry, your friends. I'm pretty sure they're explicitly not brothers.
Brothers can be figurative. That's fine.
Sure, yeah. Your bros. Just to get them to follow you every now and then would have been, like, a huge quality of life improvement. I suppose that would then sometimes lead you into, you know, leaping over a chasm with Eric and then the other two fall to their deaths, but...
Letting you have the ability, I think, would have been a pretty good quality of life improvement. And if you even wanted to be a little bit more sophisticated, they could have had them follow you, except in such cases where they would go off a cliff or something. But at that point, honestly, I worry that if they'd had too many automation elements in The Lost Vikings along that line, it would have further emphasized the extent to which there's less game there than might appear.
It's a good point.
So that's The Lost Vikings. Pleased to go back to it as, you know, I might call it the Ikaruga effect. A couple levels at a time, sure. But past that, some problems start to develop, although for different reasons. And now a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
And we're back. And we now move on to our feature game, which is Dragon Age The Veilguard, released this year, 2024, by BioWare. This is the fourth mainline Dragon Age game after Origins 2 and Inquisition. They appear to have a strange fixation about avoiding numbers, except for that one dalliance they had in the middle. Caitlin, why don't you give us a summary about what's going on here?
Okay, so Dragon Age The Veilguard is a continuation of the story that began in Dragon Age Inquisition and its story DLC, Trespasser. You play a character called Rook. You're recruited by Varric in his quest to find solace. And then the game opens in the city of Minrathis in Tevinter, where Solas has just begun his ritual to destroy the veil, which is going to flood the world with demons and be a whole lot of bad stuff. And Rook and Varric are on their way to go stop him.
I was very confused when I couldn't see any evidence of the pumpkin wedding.
Of the what?
I might have misread it as Dragon Age The Veiled Gourd. So what do you want to talk about first? The overall plot, the setting, the mechanisms? There's a lot to go over here.
Really are. We can talk about, you know, to give a quick chat about the characters first, maybe. So for me, I ended up really liking every single companion in this one, which was a big surprise to me because I absolutely did not feel that way in any of the other ones, especially Inquisition. Solas, I mean, okay, part of this was because I was treating Solas like, I don't know. Solas hated me.
Solas hates everyone.
That's fair. That's very fair.
Solas always thought that, what's the less crude version of his shit don't stink? Solas always thought he cute. And yeah. So anytime he'd be like, you're not elfy enough. I'm elfier than thou. Oh, you're not learned enough. No one's learned. He was always an arrogant jerk.
Yep. And then Sarah and I, when I first met Sarah, the first thing she did was ignore me and murder somebody. So we started off at a pretty bad foot, too.
It's important for me to remember in the context of looking back at Inquisition that it had some of my favorite companions and some of my least favorite companions, right? It was a very uneven mix. Like Cassandra and Dorian, I think, are two of the all-time great BioWare companions, not even just Dragon Age.
Yeah.
But by the same token, Cole and Sarah and the Kunari guy, voiced by Freddie Prinze Jr., strangely enough, just didn't do anything for me. I didn't hate Bull as much as I hated Sarah and Cole, but they just I just ignored them, and they just weren't a major factor in my overall appeal of the game. But again, Cassandra and Dorian in particular were just so well done. Cullen was great too.
Mm-hmm.
The returning characters were great. I mean, Varric is pure charisma and chest hair.
Yep.
He was great as well. But
yeah.
So yes, I agree. All the companions in Veilguard I have enjoyed, with one exception though. I don't hate her, but I don't like Ballara. Ballara is a character type that we've seen a million times before, even in other Dragon Age games. The absent-minded, hyper-enthusiastic tinkerer. Just the difference is, I much preferred it the way that it was done in previous Dragon Age games, where that was always presented as a dangerous person who tended to mess with things they didn't understand, leading to interesting conflicts where, like, I'm sympathetic with you, I like you, I think, but don't, no, stop, put that down. Whereas in the context of Veilguard, it's kind of shaved off, where it's like, oh, she's just a quirky inventor that solves problems. It's like, okay, fine.
Yeah, so for me, I actually, Ballara grew on me a lot over the course of the game. By the end, I absolutely loved her. Early on, I was just like, okay, you're there.
Yeah, can we circle back to that a little bit? I just want to emphasize something. You have a full-time job, 5 mammals, and a child that depend on you for survival.
Yes.
And you finished this thing.
I did. I am really bad at... I mainlined the game.
Yeah, clearly.
I worked, and I did take a break. You know, I would do dinner with my family, and then I would immediately get right back on Dragon Age. I definitely stayed up too late. I was up till 2 a.m. once, which was very, very stupid, because I still had to wake up at 7 o'clock for school getting ready and work getting ready stuff. So mistakes were made. But when I'm really into something, I have a very hard time switching off of it and thinking about other things. So yes, I did finish it. I clocked just under 70 hours doing absolutely everything that I found. That doesn't mean that it's a completionist thing, because I'm sure that I missed some stuff. I already know that there's like a post-credits scene, which I won't talk about other than to say that there is one that I missed. So I missed at least one thing. Yeah, it was really good. It was a good time.
Okay. Sorry, that kind of led us into your overall impressions, which is a little bit premature, I think.
Yeah,
Circling back to the characters, were there any particular standouts for you?
So for me, I mean, they all grew on me so much. So, I mean, I immediately liked Nev when I met her. I immediately liked Lucanus. Mm-hmm. Davrin seemed like a little bit of a jerk at first, but I grew to absolutely love him. Yeah.
I really like Davrin.
He made what sounded like a snotty comment at one point, and I don't even remember what it was about, but I was like, excuse you. And then Emmerich took a while, but he grew on me.
Oh, Emmerich had me instantly. The moment Emmerich showed up, it's very much in the way of a lot of these games that we've talked about. He's just a couple steps away from a stock archetype.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rendered with so much charisma and affection, and he's just so polite and kind.
He is.
He's there to support you. He's there. He knows more than you do about everything, but he's not going to hold it over your head. He's not going to talk down to you. He's there to help you out and for some tea. That's what he's there for.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. So I don't know if you're familiar with the meme of Rosa Diaz from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where she's like holding the puppy. And she says, I've only had Arlo for a day and a half, but if anything happened to him, I would kill everyone in this room and then myself.
Yes.
That's how I felt about Manfred. And Asan, but mostly Manfred, because I just love that little skeleton guy. It's just so freaking cute.
Yeah. They managed to make a reanimated corpse adorable.
I know, I don't understand how they did it, but they did.
And that's one of the things that I find very reassuring about this. Speaking, it's going to be very difficult to talk about the Veilguard in isolation for very long at all, right? But for my situating the Veilguard in terms of the overall oeuvre of BioWare, I approached it with no expectations and a fair amount of trepidation.
Mm-hmm.
Because the legacy of Andromeda looms large.
Yes.
And Andromeda was a bland failure on mm-hmm. any number of levels. Some people love Andromeda, more power to you. I'm just not there with you. And up until that point, BioWare had done only things that I loved. And then Andromeda came out. And so it's impossible to go back and remember what it was like where they were 6 for 6. There's some huge difference in my head between 6 for 6 and 6 for 7. And that's even setting aside Anthem. So maybe 6 for 8, whatever.
Sure.
And it was very reassuring immediately upon starting the Veilguard to be like, oh, Harding, Varric, I love you people.
Mm-hmm.
You made me love you. And I have faith, just enough faith to think that BioWare will make me love other people in this game as well. And sure enough, they did.
Yeah.
And so that I found immediately reassuring.
Yep, I completely agree. So one thing that I heard that seemed a little odd, but I've heard it from multiple people, is that the game is boring for the first 10 hours and that they thought it had the hinterlands problem without the hinterlands.
Really?
I don't see it at all, honestly. And I don't entirely know what they're talking about, but I mean, it starts with you going to confront Solas, right? Like, it's, yeah, I don't know. I was surprised at that comment.
So I'm in a very different position from you. I actually did manage to find a way to look it up. I am 16 hours into the Veilguard. And I have no conception about how far in I am, because it's been made increasingly apparent to me over doing this podcast that I tend to play games more slowly than other people do. And I only just got all my companions together. And that's usually one of the benchmarks you can establish for when the game really starts in earnest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you got your crew together? I get the sense that Veilguard takes a little bit more leisurely approach to getting your crew together.
Yeah.
That happens a little bit later on in the game. But nonetheless, I think if anything, the pacing of Veilguard is a little too aggressive for its own good. I don't think it has a hinterlands problem. I think if anything, it's a little too abrupt in a number of ways. Let me give two examples. One mm-hmm. of them is a character bit, which to round up the discussion of characters, and another segues into to a broader conversation because I'm very curious about your thoughts.
Okay.
The character bit was, you see a little exclamation point above your on the map over the icon of one of your companions when it is time to start one of their side quests that is related to them. And one of them showed up on a new character that I just recruited. I'm like, oh, you're not very interesting to me yet. But again, I have faith, and it's already been demonstrated that BioWare hasn't lost their magic of characterization to a large extent. I'm very curious to learn more about you, hear where you're coming from. Let's go have a dialogue, and you're going to lay out what your quest is going to be. I show up, I hit talk, they issue one line of dialogue, and I get a new quest marker, and that's it. And like, this is very much not what I'm used to in the context of BioWare games.
Yeah.
And one really gets the sense... It's fascinating. I find this structurally fascinating because Dragon Age, especially, much less than Mass Effect. Mass Effect was a cohesive experience driven by the fact that it was all in the same console generation. It was all about the same character. It was one overarching plot. And there was a certain unanimity, a certain uniformity, even as they revamped the combat system between 1 and 2. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Every time you get a new Dragon Age, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Right? It's like they're starting from scratch every time. And you always get to wonder... what set of criticisms, what problems, what questions are BioWare answering this time?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes this leads to catastrophes like the Hinterlands, because they decided, you didn't like constrained maps? Let's kind of make this an open world thing. Oh, great. Good job, guys. Fail. Sometimes it's answering the right question. In the context of the Veilguard, one of the things they seem to want to do is just increase the pace.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your impression as well?
Yes and no. So definitely early on in the game, I thought that the pace was quite brisk. Then later, there was two chapters where... the game is split into, I think, roughly 14 chapters. Early on in the game, you are going through those chapters pretty darn quickly. I hit one point where I think I was in one chapter for 3 days. Granted, these were 3 days playing after work. And that wasn't because I was doing story stuff, though. That's because I was feeling bogged down by companion quests and area quests, side quests. I realized that I don't technically have to do all of them, but I felt like I wanted to do all of them. So I felt like the spread of the side and companion quests was very heavily weighted toward later in the game. It's possible that that's partly because I just didn't do some of them early enough. Maybe if it had been a little bit more spread out, it would have felt better. But I felt like the pacing was really fast at the beginning, very slow, like as I approached the end, and then, you know, the end was fine. But
Interesting. I'll be looking forward to experiencing that and seeing whether I agree. So, and this leads, I think, to a huge issue, tying some of those things together. what is this like for people coming from Trespasser? And what is this like for people not coming from Trespasser? Because clearly, it's been 10 years. You want to make sure that this game can be played by anybody. I can speculate about what this would be like for somebody who has never played a Dragon Age game before. But I'd be more curious to hear your speculations. How well do you think they set it up for someone who's unfamiliar with the setting?
Oh, man. I didn't even think about that. It's almost a little difficult to put all of my Dragon Age-y stuff aside. I mean, it's funny because you start the game. I guess you could just, you create Rook. And then after creating Rook, they're like, hey, by the way, you want to create the Inquisitor and you can like make some choices for them. I guess you could just go with default choices if you don't know what's going on, which would be fine. I would assume that somebody who doesn't know anything about Dragon Age would feel pretty overwhelmed by all of the characters and the amount of stuff and might be confused, but I have no idea.
It's weird because the confrontation between Varric and Solas at the very, very beginning of the game, on one level, works even if you don't know who these people are. Solas is trying to do something terrible. Varric is trying to stop him. And it's very clear that Solas is somewhat sympathetic to his friends, but at the same time, an arrogant jerk who has his vision is not going to compromise his vision for anyone's gainsaying. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what the Veil is. You don't know what the Fade is. You don't know who Elghanan and Gilanane are. You don't know about Varric and Solas' past relationship. You just know that it happened. And a whole bunch of other stuff, right? So on that level, I think it kind of works. Half the time, I think that Veilguard is gesturing towards past things in a very successful way. And half the time, I think it's gesturing in a very unsuccessful way. So unsuccessfully, I think, are some of the cameos from characters of past games. So like someone will just show up and they were a companion from a past game. And most of the time, I look at them and like, I think you look funny and I don't think you sound right. And no, I'm serious.
Yeah, like, no, I get it.
I get that you're trying to, I don't know, call it fan service, call it continuity, call it references to past works, whatever. But there have been a number of companions from past games that show up and like, something's off.
Yeah.
They're just introduced in an offhanded kind of way. And it's sufficiently casual that I kind of respect that they're doing this for people that don't have any sense of who these people are. But at the same time, it happens so casually and they look so... sometimes it's just physically they look so different. I'm thinking specifically of Dorian. Not necessarily spoiler, but Dorian shows up and it's like, is there another guy named Dorian? Because I knew Dorian and you, sir, are no Dorian.
I know. I was like squinting at him being like, okay, he's got a mustache. I think that's him.
I think they could have spent a little bit more time acknowledging this person's significance.
Mm-hmm.
Not so to the point where somebody who doesn't know the series is like, apparently this guy's a big deal, but just a little bit. Come on. And I feel the same way about some of the other stuff. Like, what the hell has the Inquisition been up to for the past 10 years? We are coming off. This is, like, in terms of plot, in terms of direct events, this is a direct continuation of Trespasser. Trespasser was a brilliantly done DLC that was entirely about the fate of an organization, about the status of an organization, what it was supposed to do, what it had done, where it was going to go going forward. And indeed, the start of the game, a Veilguard asks you, what about the Inquisition? What happened to it? Why did it happen this way? Oh, by the way, tell us what the Inquisitor looked like. Oh, here's Harding. Harding is an active agent of the Inquisition. And then silence. And it was jarring as all get out for me. I'm still trying to get over it.
There were a number of things related to the Inquisitor and the Inquisition in general that felt very strange to me. In general, my biggest disappointment with this game was related to them not using Dragon Age Keep. So they come up with Keep before Inquisition to kind of gather all the decisions that you made through Origins and Dragon Age 2 in order to have Inquisition have, like, basically story flags based on the decisions that you'd made. This game decided not to do that at all. And as a result, it felt weird. It didn't feel as rich to me. And I understand absolutely that there's a development cost to being able to deal with the decisions made for three previous games. But I don't know. That was my biggest disappointment. And then just things like the Inquisition. I mean, I guess the Inquisition just didn't matter if it existed because nothing. I don't know. It's weird.
I don't know about less rich. I just felt that they did it halfway. Mm-hmm. I would have been fine if they had come up with whatever story reason or even not even acknowledged. It's like, okay, well, Inquisition happened. It was a thing. But now we're talking about some other thing. Okay, fine, whatever. Even though Trespasser ends with the Inquisitor trying to decide whether the Inquisition is going to grapple with Solas, and if so, how. Fine, yeah. Whatever. Just do a shift. My objection to Mass Effect Andromeda is not that Shepard and all of Shepard's companions didn't show up in the game.
Yeah.
That's fine. Do a new setting. Do new characters. That's all okay. The problem is that Veilguard seems burdened by a lot of Inquisition stuff, but refuses to acknowledge any of the things that it's set up, even in the context of its own character creator. And that's deeply odd.
Yeah.
In terms of richness, though, I would like to push back on something, because this is where I think Veilguard does things very, very well. All yeah. these things, all these broader bits of set dressing that have been alluded to and touched on in previous Dragon Ages, I feel like I've gotten to experience in a more robust way. Like, going to Tevinter and seeing what Minrathis is like. Going to Navarra. Going to Ravain. Going to all these places that have only been referenced
mm-hmm.
is super cool. And
yes.
one of those areas where all of my previous objections about how this seems strangely calibrated for new players and unsatisfying for returning players or unsatisfying to both is completely gone. Because if you don't care about Navarra, if you've never heard about it before, whatever. It's still a place where you go and do the thing and there's some interesting people there and you're doing the thing, which may or may not be interesting to you, case depending. But as a returning player, it's like, oh, Navarra, I've been hearing about this for years.
Yeah.
Great. Show me what Navarra is like. And that part I thought was done perfectly. And I just wish they'd done the same thing with the Inquisition.
First of all, I completely agree. I love being able to see all of these areas. I thought that, I mean, I'm not going to go into any details, but there are so many amazing lore bombs in this game that just blew my mind multiple times. Like, absolutely love it. I think, yeah, my main frustration was just there were a few things that they completely avoided because there was no way. Like, for example, Fenris in Dragon Age 2. Fenris is not guaranteed to have made it out of Dragon Age 2. He was still very much related to Tevinter. It was kind of a bummer that, like, yeah, I guess he's just not going to be in this game at all because he might not have made it out of Dragon Age 2. So I guess there's stuff with the history of the previous games that sucked for me, like that it couldn't be in this one because they're only going with sure bets unless it's something specifically that you picked with your Inquisitor. But anyway, yeah, that's neither here nor there. Getting to see all these new areas was awesome.
I respect that it would have been burdensome, because in Dragon Age Origins, the Grey Warden Fs right off. At the end of Dragon Age 2, Hawk Fs right off.
Yep.
And those were satisfying conclusions and liberated them going forward. One of the reasons why Trespasser was so satisfying for me personally was it was about an ongoing organization, and it was about corruption, and it was about compromise and values and political choices. You can't really burn it all to the ground at the end of that and have it work the same way.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as I say, they clearly feel like they're in Trespasser and in Inquisition's shadow, but at the same time refuse to engage with it in a substantive way. And that combination I find deeply frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, I also feel a little bit robbed in kind of the same way by the fact that Rook is supposed to be an established character by the time Veilguard starts. Rook keeps running into people from their recent past, like in the past few years. It's like, oh yeah, you've been looking for Solas for all these years. You're really impressive. You did all that great stuff. I'm like, okay. There's a lot of tell, don't show.
Yes.
Like going on in the context of Rook specifically. And it kind of made me appreciate, again, how much of a blank slate the Warden and Hawk were at the start of the games. And how you really got to, forge your own reputation. Rook shows up with a rep. Mm-hmm. Rook shows up and is supposed to be already this tremendous badass who's done these crazy impressive things. And I'm like, why are you... maybe you could have started the game then.
Yeah. Yeah, let you get to see, you know, the mission where... I mean, okay, I have no idea how this works out if you're anything else. My Rook was a shadow dragon, and they keep referring
everyone's
to this...
Everyone's a shadow dragon. Fair. You give people the opportunity to be a violent anti-slaver rebel, and they will take it.
Yeah, yeah, my thoughts exactly. But they talk about this mission that sounds amazing when you met Varric, and it's like, yeah, I want to do that. Can I play that part of the game?
Dial the game back a couple of hours. This would have been burdensome, but do you know what game did that? Dragon Age Origins. It had a yeah. bunch of different, 2 to 3 hour adventures to start off the game, and you could have done that, and then You could have seen Rook be introduced to Varric, have Varric explain the threat that Solas is, and then every player, whether they're new or returning, gets to be onboarded at the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it would have hit the pacing. Maybe, again, they just had this, they felt this need that they had to hit the ground running. They needed to start the game with a massive set piece. I don't know. But personally, I would have found that much more satisfying from a, both a character perspective and from a world-building perspective.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the combat?
Yeah, let's do it.
What class did you pick? What class was Rook?
So my Rook was a warrior. How about yours?
Mine was a rogue. Three previous Dragon Age games, three previous rogues. It's how I do.
I've been a warrior in every game except for Inquisition, where I played a mage. So I love it. I mean, it feels very...
Really?
Yeah. So it feels Mass Effect-y to me. In that you never take control of your companions. You only issue commands for them to use an ability. I really like how, I guess, active the game is. That's not to say that the combat was perfect, because I really missed a lot of aspects from the older games. I liked being able to, you know, switch over to somebody. And I don't know, I kind of liked that slower, more tactical pace in some of the previous games. But I was... all in for this, too. So it was different, but it was a different that I continued to enjoy, I guess. How about you?
So that sentiment is what I felt about the transition from Mass Effect 1 to Mass Effect 2. When they mm-hmm. completely revamped the combat system, and I thought, okay, they're making it more of a third-person shooter, less informed by numbers, more informed by your ability to aim, and they pared down the number of abilities, and they pared down your control over your companions. And for the most part, I thought that, especially the way it developed in Mass Effect 3, I felt that that promise was well done, and it was probably a good call, especially since Mass Effect 1 was clunky in a whole bunch of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel the same way about the transition to Veilguard. I feel that the transition to Veilguard, not that I was ever a huge proponent of the combat in previous Dragon Age games, I thought they were somewhere between above average to good,
mm-hmm.
But I wasn't hugely enthusiastic about them. I think that what they've done is they have taken a relatively solid, low-complexity RPG system, and they looked left, looked right, and said, well, we can't be Baldur's Gate 3, and we don't want to try to feel like some sort of MMO experience. Why don't we make this an action RPG?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did that, and I think that it is a subpar action RPG. I am, as I say, 16 hours into it. I've been a rogue the entire time. I cannot parry reliably. I do not know. The parry system is sufficiently muddy, and the telegraphing is sufficiently sloppy that I never really feel like I know what's going on. Compare this with something like Elden Ring. This is an unfair comparison. Elden Ring is brilliant. But in Elden Ring, I wasn't good at parrying either, but I knew what I had done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I always knew what the timing was supposed to be after I'd messed it up. In Dragon Age the Veilguard, my companion is yelling at me that I'm about to get hit. There's this weird color indicator over my head, and I know I'm supposed to time that somehow, and the thing that I may even see the projectile or see the animation wind up of the thing coming at me, and I feel like it's chance. I'm not saying that's because the system is arbitrary. I'm saying that it has not communicated to me clearly enough through visual and auditory cues what it is that I'm doing. And so what I'm left with is a whole bunch of chaos and noise.
Mm-hmm.
The targeting is bad. You don't have many abilities at your disposal. You're only limited to three at any given time, which is super constraining. And so I end up mashing buttons much of the time. And I do not find that satisfying in the least.
Yeah, that's fair. So I think for me, I had a really hard time with the timing at the beginning as well. I was playing Warrior. I started using a two-hander, but the parrying was not going my way. And so I made the switch over to do Sword and Shield, because then at least if I messed up the block, I would still block some damage if I did it early enough. That helped me get through like that first part of the game. And I hit game over a decent number of times early in the game because I kept dying because I was, you know, mistiming parries, blah, blah, blah. By the end, I'd gotten much better at it. It took forever. There were the number of times that I got the little help tooltip that's like, hey, if an enemy flashes red, that means it's unblockable and you shouldn't get hit. And it's like, buddy, I know there's a lot going on. The little indicator over your head felt really subpar to me most of the time because I'm in combat. I am fighting. There's a lot of spell effects going off. I'm swinging my sword. Like, sometimes that thing's impossible to see. So I definitely started off frustrated by that. By the end, I felt like I was pretty good at doing perfect, you know, a perfect block, perfect defense. But it took a while to get there. It was a lot of practice.
It really strikes me. I said before that sometimes I speculate that what's motivating BioWare is them answering the wrong questions. Mm-hmm. And honestly, so many things about the combat system feel like them doing that. It's like they look at the Souls-likes and said, oh, well, people love that crap. Let's have dodge rolling and parries in our game. And it's like, I don't want... Oh, geez, come on. Because if you're going to do that, there's a reason why the Souls games are so successful and there's a million other Souls-likes that aren't. You have to design it really properly. It has to feel right. It's one of the reasons why, you know, Lies of P was really popular after it came out, because it felt right, and a lot of the other clones don't, right? And these clones are a dime a dozen, and frankly, whenever combat starts, I feel like I'm in one of those clones. And it's just, it feels sloppy and not particularly well done. And frankly, on top of that, just to rag on it yet further, the fact that I'm limited to 3 active abilities at any given time makes my leveling decisions feel pointless. Because there's this huge network of abilities for you to unlock. But it's like, well, okay, passives are great. Fine, give me all the passives you want. But so many of them are queued to specific attack types. Mm-hmm. And then that would be require me to unlock another active ability. But I'm happy with the 3 I've got. I don't know which one I'd sacrifice. And so frankly, that rules out all the new actives and a whole bunch of the new passives. And so I end up, like, when I get new points to spend, it feels like a chore.
Interesting. So at the very beginning of the game, I opened it up. I saw that giant wheel of all the different skill points you could pin in. And I was like, oh my God, I don't have time for this. So I phoned it in and just picked things that sounded fun until sometime after I recruited all the companions, I reset my talent tree. And I was like, okay, I've decided I'm going to do like a fire sword and shield build. And then I more carefully combed through and was able to build something that ended up actually being super fun. It was not a nice experience getting to that point, which was a little bit of a bummer. I've seen the complaints about like, oh, talent trees, you know, like it's so overwhelming and therefore we're going to pare it down to just a couple options. But then that's frustrating because people feel like they don't have options. And I don't know what the answer is. I just know that it started feeling pretty overwhelming at the beginning, starting in the middle of this giant circle of points.
You're probably right that I should reset everything and build to spec, because if something that looks appealing is 5 steps away, I can't convince myself to start building towards it and have useless point spends for the first 4 levels. And it would probably work better if I just started from scratch, because I do now understand the game mechanisms a little bit better. But frankly, much of the time, as I say, I feel like so much of it is gated behind the game expectation that I'm going to engage with some of the core moment-to-moment combat inputs. And in Veilguard, the core combat inputs are things like dodge rolling, bad targeting, and sloppy parrying. And frankly, that's not making me super enthusiastic about all the combat stuff, honestly.
That's understandable. I did end up really liking it, but I can see how not everybody would. One thing that I'm pretty curious about is what it's like playing a mage, if mage just is, you know, sitting there, you know, slinging bolts of fire from their staff or what. Like, I don't know. It feels like it should be different from playing warrior or rogue, where you're actually like in melee hitting things, but I don't know.
Well, speaking as a rogue, because all the rogues are combat archers, most of the time, if you have a heavy taunting things, you might have a few uninterrupted seconds of archery. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's a classic RPG setup that we've been in a million times before. You get off a couple shots while they charge, and then it's melee for the rest of the time.
I see.
This is a dynamic that repeats in all kinds of games and all kinds of media all over the place. And it's fine. I mean, I'm not saying it's useless. I do get couple shots off, and it is helpful. But I would be somewhat surprised if it were at all different for mages. Not that I've seen anyone play a mage.
Yeah. So my biggest complaint, you've talked a couple times about, you know, BioWare responding to a complaint about a previous game. And I don't know if I heard this complaint more widely. But for me, one of my biggest complaints about Inquisition was that once you find Skyhold, the stakes are on the ground. Like, nothing bad happens. You just have victory after victory after victory.
People didn't like how Dragon Age 2 wasn't a power fantasy, so they wanted to give you a power fantasy. That's my cynical take, yes.
So it felt like they just went way too hard in the, you know, this big bad is not a threat at all. And I feel like Veilguard is back to like, yeah, things could be quite bad. It shows us what's at stake. We don't win everything, or if we do win, we don't always win like overwhelmingly in a positive way. And I've really liked that so far.
That's true. The overall structure of it is much better than I feared, because I felt that after Trespasser, I didn't know where they could go, because they show Solas at the end of Trespasser petrifying the final boss without even waving his hand. And like, mm-hmm. How do you set up a game? But they do it. They do a great job. And the other thing that I think, normally I don't pay attention to this, but the other great thing that they do, so I love the characters. I love the overall arc of the story that they're telling. I love the fact that we're getting all these references to past things that we only heard about, but we get to go there and see it, and they don't do it in an ostentatious way. I think another thing worth stressing is that I think that the Veilguard is one of the best-looking games I've played in years.
Oh my god, the hair? Have you seen the hair?
The hair is super well done.
Oh my god, yeah.
There's not a whole lot of variety in it, but it's well-rendered.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the shots are just really impressive. There's this conceit where the main character, Rook, talks to Solas at various times. And just the framing of that shot and the execution of it. And so frequently, I'm just wandering around in a map, going from point A to point B, and it's like, wow, this level looks really good.
Yeah.
And I don't often have that reaction when playing even contemporary AAA games. And so I think they've done a stellar job of the visuals all told. It's got its own visual style. The clothing is all very inflected by the people or culture from which it comes. And so it doesn't look like generic fantasy. It's weird because in some ways, you know, comparing this to Metaphor ReFantazio, right? Metaphor ReFantazio has no elves, no dwarves, you know, no stereotypical demons, but it comes off as far more stock medieval fantasy with goblins and mages and all the other kinds of stuff and griffins and blah, blah, blah. But Dragon Age, the Veilguard, has griffins and elves and dwarves, and yet it feels like much more of a real place and a place of its own characteristic, unique setting.
Mm-hmm.
Partially by virtue of the work that it's done in past games, but partially, I think, just because of the stellar design, all told.
Yep, I completely agree. It's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I went into the character creator and I picked one of the canned Rooks at first because she had really long hair, and I kind of turned her and I saw her hair actually like swing around and like then fall off her shoulder, and I was like, oh my god, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
So suffice to say, those, let's be honest, 24 graphic designers who worked crunch for months, we see you, we appreciate your work.
Yeah, gorgeous. Oh my god.
So with all that having been said, love the setting, loved it for years, love the characters, I've loved some of them for years. I think they dropped the ball in a number of areas, especially in combat. I think that by not a small margin, this is my least favorite Dragon Age so far. Which is to say, I'm going to finish it, I'm enjoying it, I'm liking it, but I think it's a significant step back. Not to the same extent as Andromeda. Mass Effect Andromeda, I finished purely out of like reflex. You know, there's some games or shows or movies that you finish, it's like, well, sunk cost, might as well see the rest of it.
Yeah.
And that I am motivated to finish Veilguard, and I'm going to finish it before going back to Metaphor ReFantazio, before going back to Fire Emblem, which I absolutely intend on still doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but feel that a sense of curiosity about where this is in the overall arc of things. Because let me draw an analogy from TV shows. And I apologize if I'm going to refer to TV shows that you haven't seen. So like there are shows like The Wire, where everyone pretty much agrees that all 5 seasons were great. And then there are shows like Dexter, where everyone agrees that there was a tipping point, and after that, it just wasn't the same. But then there are shows like Friday Night Lights, where they had some weak seasons in the middle, and then they rallied. And I don't know where we are, right? Either in Mass Effect or in Dragon Age. Because both series, I think, are coming off of their, to my mind, their weaker entrance. And to a certain extent, especially in terms of the combat, without a real sense of what it is, about what it's doing. Because I really, again, I feel like this is a weak combat system ripped from a genre that is not suited. And so I'm wondering whether this is part of an overall decline. Whether this is just, you know, we're never going to get back to those days of, you know, pre-Trespasser, pre-Citadel BioWare.
Mm-hmm.
Or if this is just a bit of a recalibration and things are going to get better. But as a longtime Dragon Age fan, that's what I'm left wondering. Is this as good as we're going to get going forward? In which case, I'm a little regretful. Or is this sort of a bridge and they're going to get under surer footing? It's tough to tell. The cynic in me, the pessimist in me seems to want to say, well, like, it's never going to be as good as it once was. But I'm at least happy that Veilguard is as good as it is. Because it could have been a lot worse.
Absolutely. I think that I'm really curious to hear how you feel when you do finish it. Because, like I said, I beat it last night. I definitely would rank it over Inquisition, which I crap on a lot, but I really liked. Mm-hmm. I loved Inquisition. I have no idea yet where it fits in with the other two. And I think I need some space from it to be able to figure that out.
And again, just for context, part of this is because Mark loves stories about institutions and compromise and conflict of values. And that's not the story that Veilguard wants to tell. This is not a story of institutions. This is not a story of organizations. This is a story of a small group of people trying to do a very difficult thing. And that's fine. It gets to tell that story. I'm not saying it shouldn't, but it's just Origins and Two and Inquisition were all, to varying extent, stories of institutions. And that just speaks to me on a fundamental way that I very much appreciate. And I will maintain that the combat system is genuinely subpar, but a lot of the rest of the stuff is just, I wish they had done things to cater more to my set of preferences. And I don't know how many Dragon Age fans there are who are like, yeah, I didn't like Trespasser. Like, there may be some, but frankly, the fact that they're simultaneously in, as I've said before, in Veilguard, they're kind of shackled to Trespasser, but at the same time, they're not engaging with it in a substantive way. That awkwardness is just deeply uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think they should have made some clearer-headed decisions about that. Maybe it's too many cooks. Maybe it's answering the wrong questions. I don't know. But maybe it's as you say. You've been very, very kind, not to phrase it this way. But you're basically telling me that I should L2P nub. And maybe when I'm where you are, I'll be able to talk about these things. But as I say, about 20 hours in, this is where I'm sitting.
Yeah, L2P nub.
So that is Dragon Age the Veilguard. Caitlin speaking from a position of completion. My speaking from a position of noobness. Let us now move on into some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So today I'm going to shout out Path of Exile 2. It has a early December 2024 early access release date. I played Path of Exile a lot a few seasons back. I had a really good time with it. My husband had played the Diablo 4 beta and was like, oh man, I really want to play ARPG. How do I do that? I'm going to suddenly go, you know, full into Path of Exile. And he played significantly more than I did. But I played a lot on that one season. And I really like the build flexibility. And I'm just excited to see what they're going to do with Path of Exile 2. I don't know when I'll get around to playing it. I'll probably just play whenever my husband decides that he wants to play it. So I don't know if I'll play it in early access or not. But I'm excited about it.
Good stuff. I always unfairly get Path of Exile confused with Pillars of Eternity.
Yeah.
And that other one that Larian does, I don't know. This is me just being intellectually lazy.
Divinity Original Sin, that one?
There you go.
Okay.
I don't know why. They don't even sound similar. I get them confused all the time.
Yep.
I remember your husband playing Path of Exile. He brought his Steam Deck and a mouse and a full keyboard. So he could keep playing Path of Exile. It's like, this is a strange setup, but whatever makes you happy, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds a lot like him. What are you shouting out this week, Mark?
To fully complete beating the dead horse, I am going to shout out Mass Effect 5. Here's why. I have had a lot of opportunity playing Veilguard, playing the new Mass Effect board game, to reflect on one of the greatest losses that we've ever experienced in gaming, and that is the end of Mass Effect 3 multiplayer. And the fact that it has not come back. I understand why it hasn't come back. This is not a criticism. Let us just be thankful that it ever existed with all its glorious free DLC and server maintenance that I'm sure saw not a whole lot of return.
Yeah.
It was so well done. And I have never seen its equal since. Mass Effect 3 multiplayer was an amazing PvE, cooperative, heavily build-focused, asymmetric thing with lots of interesting stages and enemy types. I was playing the Mass Effect board game and you know, one of the enemies is an engineer and just remembering all the glories of fighting engineers in Mass Effect multiplayer. Here is my hope. There is a possibility. They could even hide it behind any number of extortionate extra fees. But there is a possibility that when Mass Effect 5 rolls around, the multiplayer has stayed alive in people's imagination. Because when the Legendary Edition for Mass Effect got released, there was a substantial amount of discussion about that there wasn't any multiplayer. So it's not like we're the only ones, Caitlin,
yeah,
who mourn its absence. So there's a chance that they'll find a way to make it sufficiently mercenary in Mass Effect 5, and maybe they'll be like, oh, well, just redo what we did in Mass Effect 3 multiplayer. I'd be fine with that. I would give them any amount of money that they wanted. There's a chance.
Yeah.
As I say, BioWare routinely learns the wrong lessons and answers the wrong questions. But there's a chance.
We all can hope.
Because I remember thinking when Andromeda came out, it's like, well, even if Andromeda is terrible, at least the multiplayer will be back. And they managed to ruin that too, so.
Yeah, it just wasn't the same at all.
It's true. Well, with that note of perverse optimism and cynicism all wrapped into one, we will wrap up our episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. Thank you so much for joining us, dear listeners. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your contributions. We really appreciate it. It means the world to us. I'm personally very, very gratified by the level of engagement and support we've received.
Yeah, I'm super thrilled. I've been having a lot of fun reading people's comments, and it's the first time I've read comments and actually been happy about it. So, you know, that's good.
And we are still yet young. We rely entirely on word of mouth to get the word out. So if you like what you hear, please do tell a friend. And if you hate what you hear, please do tell two enemies. And so we hope to see you again soon. Take care. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.